Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. I guess before we start, there might be a number of organizational issues. Main problem always the tutorials. Have you all received this email and was it more or less clear? I just found out today, I already printed out these paper sheets and then I was told that it's not really necessary. So if you have any problems to find a group which is suitable for you, then please go to the group which is better for you and ask the tutor. That's all I can recommend. If he is happy, this is Rui and Thomas, then it will be okay.
Well, I haven't received that email yet.
No, but everyone else has. So please write to. Can you ask somebody to forward it to you? That's one option. Or you write to the ITO, because I was not really aware how this process was going on. It was somehow started. I initiated this, but then I lost control, and somehow I'm not really sure. So please ask ITO. They are in charge of this. That's what I understand. One other important point is about class representatives. I guess you need one representative for the course who is maybe taking your suggestions or complaints about the course and decides what to do, whether it's maybe a matter to discuss with ITO or maybe something to do which I would prefer to discuss with me. Any volunteers for this? You were first? Or is it okay?
Yeah.
Can you send me maybe an email?
Sure,
thank you very much. So we still cannot start. So next week there will be tutorials, and to get started I just repeated the last year's puzzle, so to say, and please have a look, possibly before the tutorial, and use the tutorial mainly to get a little better idea how genetic algorithms work in general, and more importantly also to discuss with your tutor the particular question in the assignment, which is the next sheet which I will give out. So previously there was the due date for this first assignment on 14th of October, but I guess you will not complain if it's 1 week more, that you have 3 weeks altogether. On the other hand, I guess in week 5, there will be probably already a lot of other assignments, so maybe it's a good idea to start early. I didn't include the submit command on this sheet, but you will find this on the internet page, or I will mail it also maybe in a week or so when I can expect the first of you being finished with the work. One final point is probably you have noticed already, so on next Tuesday I will be away, and that's why we cancel the lecture and continue in a week on Friday. It says 21st, yeah, does it? Yeah, so I decided to extend the deadline for one more week, and I have informed the ITO, so it should work. Which doesn't mean that you cannot submit it already by the 14th, but yeah, there's one more week. Okay, very good. Yeah, so we know now how genetic algorithms work. There will be one more example, or maybe a few more examples in the tutorials next time. And also we will have to discuss a number of practical issues. But it might be a good idea to think a little bit why they actually work, or what is really the reason that allows us to hope that they do work in this kind of generality that is often claimed for genetic algorithms. And in contrast to many other of these media heuristic algorithms, in genetic algorithms, there was very early a mathematical proof that maybe doesn't really apply to all variants, but for this canonical variants, it gives some kind of a good idea that things are bound to go well. And because of this importance that this schema theorem had on the development of genetic algorithms in particular, or meta heuristic algorithms in more general, it's really worth to have a look on it. It doesn't really make a lot of mathematical assumptions. It just takes a few steps and then we will be through, and that's what I would like to achieve in this lecture. So the question is what we are talking about. Yeah? If we talk about solution spaces, or if we are talking about schemata or schemas, which is probably perfect to say as well, to find some kind of a mathematical framework which maybe not for all variants, but at least for what we call the canonical algorithm, expresses the space, so to say, where the individual lives in, and any kind of performance of the algorithm is some kind of a dynamical process in this search space. And if we are talking only about zeros and ones in our strings, in our individuals, then most natural, it's hypercube, which is presenting one of its corner for each of the individual in the population. So of course, there might be identical individuals in the population, but there may be many individuals on one corner, but each corner is, so to say, one possibility for a solution of the problem. There might be additional restrictions on admissibility of solutions, such that the hyperspace is not fully open to exploration by the algorithm. But it makes much sense to think of this kind of search space not so much as two-dimensional plane where we have just some hills, but rather than this more complex object. Well, here is a four-dimensional version and three-dimensional version. I don't know, can you really imagine these four-dimensional cubes? And if so, can you go a little bit higher? It's a little bit hard if you have to imagine like four-dimensional mountains or something like this. But these cubes, it's at least you can really represent it quite understandably on a plane. So it's really possible to think a little bit about this. And they have a very strange geometry in the sense that in a plane you can only go to four directions essentially, but on this cube, I mean, you have only in a planar cube, in a two-dimensional cube, which is a square, you have only two directions. And for each additional dimensions, you get one more direction in which you can go. And so it's quite well connected. On the other hand, it becomes also with higher dimensions. And we are talking about, I don't know, 100 million of dimensions if we want to go to the size of the human genome, for example, or billions. Then you have really a lot of directions, but still, in order to move from one end to the other end, what do you have to do? You have to flip each single bit. So for example, in this three-dimensional, if you want to go from 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1, you have to go on one of the sides, which induces 1, 1. Then you induce a second one, and then you introduce a third one. So it takes always n steps to go from one corner to the other. And if n is large, then this is already distance, and also these different paths which lead from one corner to the other corner become much and much higher in number. such that it's really hard probably to identify, or it's obvious that it's hard to identify a particular point that might be a distance away and might easily be missed by just taking the other part. But the nice thing about these algorithms is that they are not too much localized in the sense. So obviously, if you have a certain string, then it's on one corner. If you have these 2 to the power of n corners in a large cube, then even a large population of a few thousands or maybe million individuals will not really cover a large space. But if you introduce this kind of notation here, that you just admit that you are not really interested in all of the single bits, yeah, then things become much very quickly very easy. Yeah, so for example, if you just introduce one single question mark here, in the sense that for this middle bit, no decision is taken. Now, this could either be simply because this bit doesn't contribute to the fitness function, or because maybe there are 2 individuals in the population, one with the 1 here and one with the other here, whereas the zeros are already specified, because this might be very important bits and the other one not so. Or the population is just so diverse that maybe one of the good choice is not really everywhere in the population already. And so this kind of object, be it represented as in the actual population, in the numerical representation, as it wishes, it corresponds not to one of the corners, but to one of the lines here. Yeah? And if we continue with this process, that we, for example, consider, you know, whatever, 2 empty space slots here, then we have already a plane. Yeah? So in this sense, by just specifying a single bit and leaving the other open, we cover a much larger part, you know, than by just moving to one of the corners of this search space in which the genetic algorithm lives. So in this sense, it's if we can really make sense out of this one here, then it's already a drastic reduction of the complexity of the problem and an enhancement of the algorithm, so to say, because the now which one is it? The upper one, yeah, because. This one restricts the search space to a much smaller area of this hypercube than what was just accessible by single individuals. And these objects here, with just a binary string that we, of the same type as we are using it for the individuals, plus this undecided or star or question mark. This gives us already what is a schema. Huh? So the schema is, so to say, nothing but a selection of bits which are somehow important. Well, maybe they are not really important in the end, but at a certain level of the algorithm, they are important. Why they are important? Simply because they have survived so far. Huh? So that's why there might be some kind of importance to them. Maybe others will take over, other better solutions will be discovered, and also better sub-solutions or building blocks. But at this moment, the mere presence of such configurations in the population indicates that this really contributes something to the improvement of the total population at this particular steps of the algorithm. So this was somehow the idea of John Holland when he introduced these schemas that were meant to be in correspondence to the idea of a gene. Yeah? So this schema is somehow a genetic representation of a feature of the individual. And the schemata, which are important, they are selected according to a fitness function, according, so to say, to an environment or whatever is included in this fitness function. And so they are in our genetic algorithm the same as a gene in biology. Yeah? So mathematically it's very easy. Yeah? It's a schema, it's just a string that contains these wildcard symbols. For some mathematical consistency reasons, we exclude from the schemata those which have only these wildcard symbols. Yeah? Because the idea is that they correspond to something in the real world, and if you don't know anything, it doesn't correspond to anything, and therefore this is not allowed. Yeah? But it's just a formal decision which is taken. So anything like this one is a schema. Yeah? And we like to describe these schemata mainly by their order, so how many bits are present. And in addition, it plays also a role how much localized they are. So here in this case, there are six symbols, we will rather describe it by the interconnection, so to say, so between 0, 1, 1 star, 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 star 1. There are five spaces, and so it's a schema of length 5. Yeah? But we will discuss this in a bit more detail. And so the nice thing about the schemata is that they have this a kind of an extent in the hypercube which is searched through that is really comparable to the hypercube. So we have a lot of different schemata, and so a schema, because it just contains a fewer bits than the full chromosome corresponding to the optimal solution, for example, is much easier to be found. And also it somehow corresponds to these hyperplanes and covers in this sense also a much, or if the schema was good at least, it would cover a larger part of the, or restrict the search to a large part of the search space. So that's why these schema are very nice. And the more nice thing is that there's really some kind of statement which can be made about schemata. And this statement is really meant to answer the question, how do genetic algorithms work? So it's quite a while ago. And in the meantime, of course, a lot of variants of this schema theorem have been proposed, which also cover algorithms of a slightly different flavor. So what we have here is a number of symbols, yeah? And so just step by step to analyze it. What we immediately see is that there is here one bracket, and there is some other expression over here, which maybe also be considered as one group. So there are these three groups, which we will discuss in detail. And on the other hand, there is an expectation value. Yeah? So it's something related to probabilistic representation of the algorithm, which is given simply by the selection rules. So we have this probabilistic ingredient in the algorithm, and that's why we cannot really expect to have strict statements, but we can have strict statements with respect to the expectations. And what does it tell us is that this expectation is larger than some kind of large expression, and it is an expectation of the number of copies of a certain schema at a given time. Yeah? And so this makes sense here. What we have here on this side is the number of this schemas or of at the time before, and so we can ask what is later. So H denotes all the individuals which have somewhere this schema. So the schema has this kind of wildcard symbols, and H is just all these the number of those which carries the schema with any kind of arbitrary symbols on those places which are not specified by the schema. So, for example, what we could say is here that whatever the schema could represent blue eyes, for example. Then it depends on what you probably have recognized already, mutation rate and reproduction rate as crossover rate. In some way, whether this gene might be knocked out by some kind of process during the generation of the during the formation of the next generation, or whether it survives. Yeah? So blue eyes, I'm not sure, but more generally in our algorithm, this of course will depend on the fitness of this algorithm of this particular schema. And what we need for this is an expression of the mean fitness that was there relative to the total to the average fitness. And of course, how many there were there. So if there are a lot of these, even if they are not so fit, then they have a good chance to get through. And otherwise, if the fitness of those individuals which have the schema, so the schema is meant to have a big effect onto the fitness of these individuals, but it not necessarily determines it completely. There are a lot of other contributions as well, which are due to these places where there are only wild cards. So this much for the moment. Maybe we have a look a little bit later. Where am I? In order to get a little idea about this schema tar. So what? So if you have any kind of schema which has had a good chance to survive in the population, then the question is, what will it depend on, whether it continues to survive? And what we might easily realize is that crossover and mutation can have an effect, and this effect depends on the particular shape of this schema. So for example, just compare these two ones. So if you do crossover, meaning you cut the gene at some point, which of these two will have a larger chance to survive a crossover? It's pretty obvious. So if you just select this cutting site randomly, then obviously here there's just one chance to cut this schema into half, so that each of the children gets only one of the ones, and the particular property is meant to be coded by both of them, by the presence of both of them. So it will be lost most likely. Of course, it could well be that the other parent happens to have the same configuration already, then it's not lost, but there's a good chance by this crossover to be cut. On the other hand, this one here has a lot of sites where a cut can really disrupt the ones such that one goes to one child and one to the other child. And in this sense, of course, this is much more vulnerable to this crossover than this one. So obviously the length of this schema determines how well this schema can survive in the environment or in this competition among the individuals. On the other hand, mutation is much more easy, because at least what we have assumed is that mutation just occurs randomly at any of the places. So it doesn't matter whether there are stars in between or not. If the schema has a few bits only, it's less likely that one of these few bits which are set is hit by a mutating event, rather than a schema which has a lot of bits which are set. Then of course the mutation can much easier destroy the order or the particular sequence which is maybe helpful for the individual. So, and this is expressed by these concepts here, the order of the schema, just the number of bits which are set. So this will be important for the mutation and the what is called defining length. Not to confuse it with some order or something like this. This means how many cuts could disrupt this schema. You just subtract the ordinal of the first and last bit or you count possible cutting sites, which are here in this case two, and here in this case any cut would disrupt this particular structure. So defining length and order are somehow critical for the fate of an schema, and this can be expressed by these terms in the schema theorem, in the sense that for this crossover, you just take the defining length, and the longer the you divide it by the length of the string. So they are all together, if the string has a length L, L minus one possible cutting sites, and out of these schema or the individuals with the schema have this fraction of suffering or the probability of suffering and disruption by a particular crossover event. So you can do these easy calculations here. So if you have an crossover rate of 0.8, so that a chance for an individual to enter one of these reproduction rates rather than maybe surviving as it is to the next generation. If this is 0.8 and we have a schema which is only 3 in length, then for a total length of 100 we get such a small probability for disruption. Of course, I mean, this can happen, yeah? But on the other hand, the algorithm might have meanwhile produced some copies, not maybe of the exact individual, but at least copies of the schema, if this is otherwise very helpful for increasing fitness. And that's why maybe the production of new individuals with the schema outweighs a reduction which is due to the disruption by crossover, if the schema is sufficiently short or sufficiently concentrated maybe. On the other hand, mutations, the same thing. So we have here now a mutation scheme which calculates for each of the sites an mutation rate, or draws, so to say, a random number for each of the sites. That means each site can independently be mutated. Of course, this happens only with a very small probability, such that we can just consider something like this, so that a schema survives with an length of O. Yeah? O is the size of the schema. Is just 1 minus the probabilities that it's not surviving, that this particular bit is not surviving, and for each of the bits, that's why we take the power here. So this gives us already precisely what mutation and crossover could do in the worst case, because yeah, it's always possible that this mutation, for example, doesn't really change anything. So for example, if you just choose a site and take a random number there, then maybe this random number is just what was there before. Or crossover could also lead to the effect that maybe two identical parents cross over, so that also there's no effect. So, but this gives us an idea about the worst case. And maybe with this we could go back to the schema theorem. So what we now see here, or recognize again here, are the two contributions from crossover. So that means 1 minus expresses probability not to be destroyed by a crossover event. On the other hand, this tells that it's not destroyed by a mutation. And what we see here in the middle is that, of course, there might be a larger, or we could expect a larger number of these particular schemas in the population, because yeah, sometimes these mutation and crossover are not really destroying anything, such that they only give us a lower bound. But this is not too difficult, yeah, because and not really a problem, because what we expect is that the very fit individuals, if they are, they need at least to maybe grow in the population, and it's not so much important if they grow a little bit more. And those which are not that fit, they might probably not really have a large outcome here on the left-hand side, because their fitness as compared to the average fitness is not high anyway. So what remains to be done, sorry for this jumping back and forth, is to understand the first term, but maybe we start down here. Yeah? What you see here is something like a shortcut of the full equation. Under some assumptions, you can just say something like this. So what is given here is this number of the individuals in the population with a particular schema. And this prefactor, so to say, is a relative advantage they have to other individuals. And so obviously, if this relative advantage is positive, yeah, if c is larger than 1, then next time there will be more of these, and it will just continue like this. Yeah. This is not exactly what happens, of course, yeah, because the population is finite and so on, yeah, but so this gives mainly the idea that there's always some kind of, as long as fitness is really better than others, then you will have this improvement. So what is wrong with this kind of exponential grow is simply that if you have only individuals of one particular type left, yeah, because they happen to be very successful at a certain stage of the evolution, then the fitness also will, the mean fitness will also increase. Yeah? So if all individuals are the same, then the fitness will be constant, and these individuals will have no advantage anymore. So the problem is simply that the C, which appears or seems to be like a constant here in this short sketch of what was going on before, is actually an quantity which changes in every step and which has to be checked against the mean fitness. Yeah? So this was just some kind of an extrapolation from what is justified for a single step to whatever happens in the future. But for example, if a new gene is invented, yeah, some funny mutation has happened, and a single individual with a new gene came up, then it will probably very quickly spread in the population, because it hasn't received any large numbers of, or it has not multiplied into a large number, such that the mean fitness is not essentially affected by this. Yeah, so this is just the dynamics. Okay, now we have to go back and try to find out what this evolutionary advantage, which leads to the multiplication of certain species, how this comes about. Huh? Let's maybe go back now. Sorry. So we have what we have been discussing last time is this kind of different normalizations of the fitness function. So what we want to do here is we just add all the fitness function, all the fitness values in the population, and divide by the number of individuals. Yeah? So this gives us the mean fitness, and we denote this by this bar here. And what we could say in the first approximation is that if, for example, just think of this roulette wheel selection, which we assume here as a canonical genetic algorithm, the reproduction follows the fraction of the fitness of the individual with as compared to the mean fitness. So this was the sectors in the roulette wheel, and the size, or the relative size of the sector, was just like this. Yeah? Of course, if we have an individual a number of times, then obviously it has a larger chance, or as many times a larger chance, to get through to the next generation as a single individual. So that's why we just multiply this relative fitness with the number of individuals. And of course, it's a random process, so we cannot know whether this is really is realized. but it will lead to some kind of expectation what is going to happen in the next step. And if you have large populations, then this expectation will be probably pretty close to what is really happening. And now we can just rewrite this fitness values a little bit. So for example, we could say an individual which has a little bit better fitness than others. So it means we can write what is going on in this individual in this way. Well, there is a small increment, maybe 5% above the fitness, and so we can write it here with C equal to 0.05. And this gives us now, if we insert it here, this equation, which tells us about the exponential growth. It depends a little bit what equations you are more used to. So here we have this expectation and so on, but here it's more like an assumption that everything is deterministic and so on. So what you see is the good fitness has a better chance to get through, although maybe in the next step what means a good fitness has to be revised. So it's not necessarily getting through, it can just level off and maybe stay at a certain level or maybe be suppressed by other individuals which occur and which are even of better fitness. So this was what we had seen in the first part of the schema theorem. These carriers of a certain schema. We cannot really use now here the same fitness as before for the individuals, because this is simply what we have to use here is an average over all the individuals that have this particular schema. So what we write down is simply the fitness, which has of course to be normalized later on, times number of individuals with this fitness, and we normalize it by the number of those individuals in the population which share one of the schema. And this gives us, so what is this schema on average worse for an individual. So this doesn't mean that this is a constant. Yeah? This depends very much on the rest of the population. So for example, if you have a gene that allows you to read and you live in a world where this is not really helpful for your reproduction, then it doesn't really give you any benefit. But otherwise, because all the other bits in your genetic string are maybe more important for the fitness under this condition, and so the fitness will be low. But in other societies, maybe it's better to know how to read, and that's why in this case this particular gene has a better value. Yeah. So this is just what we insert into the first part, and. We can discuss a little bit about the different normalization, but I think you can recognize, if you have another look at these equations here, recognize probably quite nicely what is stated here. Yeah? So you have two numbers which are both smaller than one, which reduce the survival rate of the fitness, and one which has a chance to increase it. And now it depends on how they balance each other. But what we can conclude is that it's good for the individual to have a high fitness. It's good to have a small defining length, or to be concentrated on a certain whatever chromosome, for example, and to be short in the sense of consisting of relatively few symbols for the encoding of this property, and those will the ones which will get through. Of course, there are all kinds of compromises possible. So maybe very important property can also be encoded by a large number of bits, because it will be very decisive about the fitness. And there are some complex proteins which occur in every single living being. They are very long and they survive, yeah, because they are just everywhere. They can never really get extinct, yeah, at least not in the near future. And so in this sense, there is some balance which is found by the algorithm and which can be different for different runs even of the same algorithm, and which determines the continuation. So what does it tell? Three parts gives you first some kind of idea that the good ones really get through, unless maybe you did something wrong with your algorithm, that either the probabilities were maybe too large, for example, for destroying what has been discovered by the algorithm, or maybe the fitness was not really sufficiently specific to, or not sufficiently well matched to your encoding scheme, in the sense that maybe you spend a lot of bits for some trivial properties, which lead to other problems here. And on the other hand, these trivial properties are not sufficiently influencing the fitness, such that this cost, which you have here, for example, in the mutation rate, is not sufficiently compensated by this fitness-related growth term in the equation. Yes, please.
So does it mean that how I represent things really influences the outcome of the genetic algorithm?
Definitely, yes. Yeah, clear. Yes, I mean, it's of course everything is stochastic here. You can be lucky, but on average, you need to make sure, that's what this theorem tells you, that you code the properties in such a way that they are efficient, yeah, in the sense of not being destroyed by mutations, using small numbers of bits only, that they are somehow in a meaningful way distributed along the genome, that those bits which can be found, which belong together, also are situated on the genome together, and that your fitness function is sufficiently specific that it really helps to the good properties to survive. Yeah. This is interesting that there are so many possibilities for fitness functions or for encodings, but you can still make some kind of a general statement about the consequences of these ones. So this is maybe like more, it's not really a recipe how to encode, but some kind of strategy which might be good to be observed in this way. And also it really tells more or less everything about almost everything about the genetic algorithm. So one bit which is missing here, obviously, is this idea what schema appears at what time. Yeah? So the missing part is obviously how different schema can be combined into a good solution. Yeah? Because in the end, at least in most cases, if you don't have a redundant coding, in the end you want to have a fully specified genome of the solution, and so you probably need a lot of schemata to be put together like Lego blocks in order to specify the solution. What is also nice about this is that this doesn't really care what the schema actually is, yeah? And this might a little bit we should not really look too much on this larger sign. Of course, the prefactor here, of course, can also be smaller than one. So some schemata which are not fit are just suppressed in this way. How these successful schemata can really be combined and what else can be wrong? This will be a second part, which is unfortunately less theoretically understood, but practically, of course, also important and will be discussed in this building block hypothesis. Yeah, we should maybe have a look to these. So let's maybe forget about the building block hypothesis and rather consider a few more examples on the schema theorem. Building block hypothesis next time. So what we see here, for example, is just whatever arbitrary problem where you would like to maximize the value of a variable. It's not that easy as this all ones problems which we have discussed last time. You are just a fitness function which might be rather complicated. And so now the question is, what is the effect of an representation of this variable in the sense of the genetic algorithms, namely by a binary string. Yeah? Often this is not so easy to understand what is really the sense. Yeah? So if you have to do this kind of optimization problem, you just choose the starting value and you go uphill. And often you just do it a number of times until you find really the global optimum. But if you have higher dimensional spaces, then this works not as easy. But what these considerations around the schema theorem imply is that this kind of locality doesn't really matter anymore if you have this kind of representation of the space. So for example, if you have found that maybe this bit here and this bit are both important for high values, yeah, then probably a lot of the individuals in the population will acquire these bits. Yeah. So the schema, which is not really deciding whether this is the optimum or this is the optimum, will have a prevalence in the population. And in this way, you do not really need to be everywhere in order to sample everything, but just need to have some kind of pointer towards these stages. And as soon as the pointer is there, because they are both quite good, and this pointer is therefore good, or the schema is therefore good, then more and more individuals which will inherit this schema, if it's a good schema as well, at least, and in this way produce more and more offspring near these points, such that ultimately, after a few more generations, this optimum is finally really discovered. Yeah? Another look we should have to this example here, maybe, just to make sure. Or maybe not. Please check this example yourself, and I will also tell the tutors to argue with you. I guess we should enjoy again this beautiful theorem. Maybe you have any questions? I guess it's important to know really either of the two formulations here of the schema theorem. And so this is like what you have to keep in mind of genetic algorithm, except of some more technical details about the operators. Any questions? Okay, yeah, so I guess I will then stop here. We will probably mention schema theorem again in order to get a good introduction to the building block hypothesis next time, which will be on Friday. Thank you very much.
Question. I read this about the assignment, and it says that the maximum number of points is 10. Does this mean that we don't really have to answer all questions if we answer 5 of them?
Yeah, if you answer 5 correctly, okay. Then you are fine. I mean, I cannot guarantee that it's enough, no, but you can at least, if you find one to has too much. So I think I made it. You need to do some computations. You cannot do it without computations. Okay. So, but you can be more efficient in this way.
Okay.
For the assignments, we can use whatever programming language you want.
I wanted to say this. In principle, yes, but you need to make take into account that I don't know all of the languages. So, so if you have some very exotic language, maybe I'm not able to understand it. And
object-oriented, like C sharp or Java, is fine.
I think that's fine. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I would probably interpret it against you if I didn't understand it. Yeah. So Haskell, I wouldn't like too much, for example, if this is possible.
Actually, I'm not included in the mailing list.
Could you perhaps send an email to ITO that you want to be included?
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. And
I'm not sure why this happened, but
okay.
I don't maintain the or
okay.
Do this mailing list.
Yeah, sure.
So about assignment, please use the opportunity to discuss in.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to.